My problem is that Vicky Berger will come and haunt me.
Calling to order the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
Yeah.
Folks, I'm going to carry many of the bills that we have on our schedule today over to our next regularly scheduled meeting next Monday. So I'm going to carry over House Bill 2343, carry over House Bill 2681, carry over House Bill 2710, carry over House Bill 2725, and I'm going to carry over the public hearing on, or the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2471. And those will all be next Monday, April 10th. And at this time, I'm going to open a public hearing on. If time allows, and it may not, there's a work session scheduled for House Bill 2111.
The amendment.
And the amendment is in. If we can work it today, if we have time at the end, we'll do that before I lose a quorum. If not, it will carry over till Monday as well. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bills 2481 and House Bill 3386. Beth, can you give us an overview and discuss what's going on with the amendments?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2481 would require gas station owners or operators to print on any receipt that an owner or operator provides to a customer after the customer purchases gasoline the cost to the customer per gallon of gasoline of the low carbon fuel standard. There's a -3 amendment on OLIS that requires DEQ to determine the average cost per gallon of low carbon fuel standard for the preceding year and requires the department to post the formula used in results no later than April 15th of each year. Or to otherwise provide it to the gas station owner. Requires owners of the operators of gas station to disclose to the customer the cost per gallon of low carbon fuel standard by either posting it on the gasoline pump, printing it on the receipt, or otherwise displaying the cost near the point of payment. And it establishes requirements for cost disclosure. House Bill 3386. Requires the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt by rule a program in which regulated parties generate and reconcile deficits to be in compliance with the low carbon fuel standard. Regulated parties and credit generators may obtain credits for fuel used as substitutes for gasoline or diesel, and people have the opportunity to trade credits to facilitate the cost of compliance. There are 4 amendments on OLIS, the -6, the -8, the -9, the -10, that I think people will probably get into more detail during their testimony.
Thank you very much. I've invited representatives of DEQ to first give us a little update on how the program is faring at the moment. And so I'll invite Palmer Mason and Corey Ann Wind up, please. Thank you for being here. I think we were planning on about 10 minutes for this, and if you could both stay around for questions, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'll go ahead and start as Corey is setting up. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I want to say that Corey will spend her time talking about, as you asked, what's happening in the Clean Fuels Program right now and why we think we are meeting the objectives and the ask that the legislature made back for us both in 2007 as well as most recently in 2015. I would like to save a little bit of time, if I might, to talk specifically about the issue of modifying the Clean Fuels Program and specifically House Bill 3386. So I would like to have a few minutes to do that because I believe that's my opportunity to do that after Corey finishes. So thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Go right ahead, Corey.
Okay. Chair Helm, representative, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Corianne Wendt, and I work for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And I am here today to update you on the implementation of the Oregon Clean Fuels Program. So this slide, to kind of just put everything into context, so this slide represents what the Oregon Clean Fuel Standards are. So this, what this graph shows is that on average, Oregon's transportation fuels getting cleaner by 10% over a 10-year period, cleaner in terms of the life cycle carbon and carbon intensity of those fuels. So the standards are designed to be phased in over time to provide time for the fuel importers to figure out how they want to comply. The way that the program works basically is that if there is a fuel that is above what the standard is for that year, it generates a deficit. And for fuels that are below the standard, it generates credits. And to be in compliance at the end of the year, the regulated parties need to balance out the number of credits and deficits to be in compliance. So we are currently in year two of the program, 2017. That's where the orange line is, and this marks a place where a 0.5% of reductions are required for the carbon intensity of the fuels from our base year time period of 2015. So with 1 year under our belt already from 2016, there are some good early signs that the program is working. Reports that have been submitted to the agency show that there's that they are over complying with the standard. In other words, that there are more credits being generated than deficits. You can see from the quarterly data, we've got some, most recently the Q4 data was just submitted by the end of last week, so it's preliminary at this point. At the end of 2016, there's approximately 175,000 credits in the bank for future use for compliance. Another good early sign in the program is that many different types of fuels are generating credits, including ethanol, biodiesel, natural gas, renewable natural gas, propane, and electricity. While the majority of the credits are being generated by blending liquid biofuels because they are required to participate in the program, we're also seeing some early generation of the other alternative fuels. So as those providers of the propane and natural gas and electricity, as more of those fuel providers participate in the program, then there will be increased generation from the from those fuels. One of the safeguards that is built into the Clean Fuels Program is a requirement that on an annual basis, DEQ does a forecast of whether there's enough fuel to comply with the future standard. So in late 2016, DEQ worked with a consultant, in this case ICF International, to forecast what the fuels would be available to the state of Oregon in 2017. This is an excerpt from a report that they have submitted to DEQ. And you can see that the forecast shows that there is enough, more than enough fuels to comply with the 2017 standards. So what you can see here on the left-hand column is the different fuels that we considered as part of the forecast and what the demand for those specific fuels were. And then the quantities of deficits and credits that are generated from those different fuels. And so even on the credit column, there are ranges of fuels, ranges of credits that we analyze, where we vary the amount of fuel that would be used for the program, and as well as we actually vary the different carbon intensities that we use for those fuels. So that's why there's a range. But even if you look at the bottom range, you know, there's enough credits to offset the deficits that are being generated. And on the top end of the range, you see that there is a large carryover of credits for those deficits. DEQ is also working with the same consultant to provide a longer-term look at the program. So in this case, we're looking out to 2025, the 10-year period of the program. So this analysis is still in draft form. We're still continuing to work with the consultant. We have some comments and some feedback that we're trying to incorporate. But the following are excerpts that have taken from the draft report that they have already submitted to us, and we believe that the same comments will still apply even after some of the comments are addressed. Most importantly, the report concludes that the Clean Fuels Program can be achieved using a diverse supply of fuels, including the ones included here. So the ethanol, the biodiesels, renewable diesels, from the various feedstocks, the different materials that are used to make those fuels, as well as from electricity, natural gas, renewable natural gas, and propane. Since the standards are phased in, it's easier and cheaper to generate credits early in the program, and that in turn reduces or delays the need for any new solutions to the later in the program. So I want to urge here that when we consider the different types of fuels that are available in this scenario, in this analysis, we use fuels that were currently available today. They're commercially available. It is existing production facilities and existing technologies, so it's nothing new. So in that sense, this analysis is a very conservative look when you think about what could happen in the future out to 2025. Lastly, the report also concludes that by using a combination of fuels and technologies, that it is possible to achieve the goals of the program without exhausting the bank of credits in 2025, and that going out towards 2027, so beyond 2025, there we also nearly achieve a point where the amount of credits and deficits are balanced, so that there is sustainability in the program if you assume that a 10% requirement gets carried on beyond 2025. We are also encouraged by data that we have taken from the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard program that shows that there is a trend of the carbon intensity of the biofuels that are being supplied to the West Coast, that there is a downward trend to these carbon intensities. Over the past 6 years, the biofuels that have been supplied to California, the carbon intensity of the ethanol has declined by about 20%, and in biodiesel even more so, up to about 50% reduction. This shows that the biofuels producers have responded to the signal of the low carbon fuel standard in California and the one that we have in Oregon Clean Fuels Program, and that they are producing, they have the ability and the know-how just to produce even more cleaner products. And what is not shown in this graph too is that what is not shown is that the future innovation that can occur in this space. That the biofuels producers are continuing to make their processes more efficient, more clean, and that there are dozens of new ways that they have been shown to actually further reduce the carbon intensities from these fuels. So a question that we get asked a lot about the impact of the Clean Fuels Program and what it has on the retail price of fuel. So since the program is a market-based program, it's very difficult for us to forecast what the market will do in the future. But one way that we can look at it is to borrow data from the California program and overlay it onto Oregon's timeline. So in this case, what we did was we took a look at the credit prices in the California program, back to when they started the program back in 2011, and what you see in the dotted line is actually the actual credit prices for LCFS credits in California. And we took that data and we overlaid it if it would start in Oregon starting in 2016. And so what you'll see here in the dotted line is that this natural variation, the natural movement in the price of credits in the California market. And then what the dotted what the solid line underneath then represents is the translation between the cost of those credits and the price, the impact on the retail price of fuel. So the way that you can read this graph is that if you look out at the far right-hand side of the graph, if credit prices are about, say, $90 right now in the California program, you know, so 4 years from now, so out in 2020 for Oregon, you might see an impact of about a quarter, about 2.5 cents per gallon increase. Okay, So, you know, this is not saying that this is what's going to happen in Oregon. This just is one way that we can analyze it. Obviously, our market is going to be a little different from California's, but this is just to kind of give some insight into how we can do, how we can look at this issue.
And if I might add to that, one of the reasons why we wanted to illustrate it this way is this is using actual real-world data taken from California, and that's why, in particular, we want to try to answer the question of what are the potential retail impacts this way. There are other ways to look at the question, as Corey indicated, but this is the reason why we decided it was best to show it this way, because it uses real-world data.
Okay. Again, as you all know, that, you know, the, when you talk about the impact of what the Clean Fuels Program has on the retail price of fuels, you have to look at it in the context of what the regular retail gas prices in Oregon are. You know, so in the, on average, the monthly price swings are about 14 cents per gallon. And this is with data that we've got back to 1999. So, you know, still if we talk about, you know, out to 5 years from now, 2.5 cents per gallon increase, then it's, you know, then it's well within kind of the normal fluctuation of the retail gasoline prices. So lastly, what we attempted to do is to set to give you an example of what a current price of the program would be. So what we're doing here is that the credit price for the Oregon market right now is about $50 per credit. And so at that credit price, at the point of the program that we're at now, so again, we're in 2017, so it's the 0.5% reduction, what that translates to is that in a worst case effect of the program on the price of gasoline, so that's the farthest one on the left, the E10 is finished gasoline. So what the impact of the program at $50 per credit now is about a quarter of a penny. And it's a little higher for the price of the B5 diesel. It's a 0.0029. This also means that the cleaner fuels like CNG that are used in the buses, like in chariots, there is a benefit to that fuel because those fuels generate credits. So that the benefit from this program is about 6 cents per diesel gallon equivalent. Or if you're using a landfill gas for a CNG, like in a garbage truck, the benefit is about 25 cents per diesel gallon equivalent. It's also showing that for applications like for electric vehicles, that for on the far right, it's a passenger, light duty passenger vehicle. So the benefit of the $50 price credit right now equates to about $1.19 per gasoline gallon equivalent. And that if you use that same electricity in something heavy duty, like an electric bus, like is being done for Lane Transit District, that equivalence, that benefit goes up to $1.83 for a diesel gallon equivalent. So this is a way that you can be able to see that there are some costs to the program, but there are also the benefits of the cost to some other alternative fuels. So.
Thank you.
I didn't, Chair Helm, I don't know if you want to take questions about Corey's presentation or should I just continue to talk about the other two bills?
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So again, Palmer Mason with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to the two bills, House Bill 2481 and 3386. And I want to recognize that I'm speaking maybe somewhat ahead of Representative Bentz, and I respectfully acknowledge that he'll be giving a presentation, but I did want to get our comments on the records about those two bills. So I'll start with House Bill 2481 and say that we have worked with Representative Bentz on a dash two, which I see now as a dash three amendment, and we have no objection to that bill, and we appreciate that he was able to work with us on that. On House Bill 3386, I do want to talk about that because I think we have some concerns, but there again, Representative Bentz has approached the department early on, and we've talked about that bill, and I suspect we'll be talking about it more as we move forward in the process, and we want to be engaged on doing that. Maybe before I talk about the specifics on that bill, I did want to make a couple of general comments. And I think it's helpful to look back at why the legislature adopted the Clean Fuels Program in the first place, both when they looked at added originally in 2007 and then again in 2015. I think the goal there with the Clean Fuels Program was to see that we got a 10% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions associated with transportation fuels over 10 years. That was one of the important reasons for adopting the Clean Fuel Program. There was a second important reason for adopting the program, and that was to make low-carbon fuels, which were even in 07 and certainly in 2015 available, more widely available in the Oregon fuel market, to help transform that market so that there would be more options for lower carbon fuels. And those two twin reasons are the reasons why the legislature directed DEQ and ultimately the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt the program. I point those two things out to say that if the legislature is going to consider modifying the program, that any alternative that's being considered ought to be evaluated against those two outcomes. We ought to know that the alternative is going to achieve the same level of greenhouse gas reductions in transportation fuels, and we ought to know that an outcome of an alternative is that it makes low-carbon fuels more widely available in Oregon. Those two things are necessary if we're going to reduce the greenhouse gases associated with the transportation sector, which is the largest sector in Oregon in terms of contributing greenhouse gas emissions. I think it's also important to know why the legislature looked at the Clean Fuels Program as a way to achieve those two outcomes. They looked at it as a pretty unique mechanism. As I said, and as Corey's slides demonstrate, there are commercially available low-carbon fuels out there. And that again, was true earlier on, and certainly it is true now. It's even more true now. If we have available low-carbon fuels out there, it seems to us it makes sense to use the market to try to encourage more private investment and build on what we already have. And the fact that we already have these available fuels, we can make them more available by encouraging more private investment in those businesses, in those producers that make these particular low-carbon fuels. I think that was a key reason why the Clean Fuels Program was selected, because it uses a market-based approach to encourage greater investment in those particular fuels. It also gives those producers something of value that they can exchange with the importers of fuels who are selling into Oregon. And that value sends price signals that, again, encourage that investment. It also sends a price signal in a way that is agnostic about fuel and fuel types. So it means that we have the greatest range of competition between different fuel types, be they biofuels, electricity, propane, what have you. And that greater range of competition ensures that there's the most likely, it helps ensure to keep the cost down for those fuels and gives the fuel importers who have the legal obligation the greatest amount of flexibility to make the choice that fits their business. So I think it's important as we talk about alternatives, again, to look at the outcomes of clean fuels and why it was selected as a mechanism to achieve those outcomes. And I'll finish by making a couple of remarks about House Bill 3386. Again, I want to acknowledge Representative Bence's work on this. It's clear to us that he has spent a lot of time thinking about this and has been very thoughtful in his approach. And so I want to recognize that, and we want to stay engaged and continue to talk. We do have concerns, though, that I want to put on the record. One is, given that there are already firms and businesses who provide commercially available amounts of these alternative fuels, and in fact, as our analysis shows, we think there are enough to meet the compliance obligations that are under the program, to us it makes the most amount of sense to encourage that, continue to encourage that private investment and continue to encourage the private market to supply the fuels that we need. The Dash 6 Amendment, which is the last amendment I've really had a chance to read, I understand that this is a fluid process and we have more amendments than that, so I'm not familiar with the later versions, but in looking at the Dash 6 Amendment, that amendment redirects millions of dollars away from private investment in alternative fuels to research projects and other proposals, electric car rebates and that type of thing. And I think we would ask, if we already have a private market that works, why would we redirect funds away from the private market into research and other programs? So I think that would be a policy question that we would pose to the legislature. I also think we have some concerns about whether the Dash 6 amendment or any of the other amendments can meet the constitutional test around Oregon's direction that tax or fuel fees on fuels have to go to the highway fund. I understand there's been some work by legislative counsel to look at that question. We haven't seen that yet, and so I don't want to stand here in front of you today and say that it's unconstitutional. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying I think there's a legal question about whether the amendment can actually be drafted or works in such a way that it doesn't violate the Constitution. So if it does, then it can potentially put the program at risk. And I understand the amendment tries to deal with that by urging a speedy resolution by the Supreme Court. But I think the fact remains there's a legal risk out there about this. Another point I think we would like to make is, as near as I can tell in the Dash 6 amendment, there is no funding for DEQ to do the work that would be required by the Dash 6 amendment, and it's quite possible that I have missed that. I can't see a source of dollars associated for the work that we would have. If you think about it, ultimately, when we get to the latter years of the program, millions of dollars would be going from the fuel producers and importers to NGOs, non-government environmental or non-government organizations, through contracts with DEQ, but there's no provision in the bill, as far as I can tell, for DEQ to be staffed up to do that. And we are talking about quite a bit of money, and we are talking about a substantial number of projects, again, ranging from research to rebates to other things like that. So it's not clear to us how DEQ would be staffed up to do that. And then the last thing I think I would say is for us, there's a question, too, about whether we can ascertain that these millions of dollars that are going into research, rebates, and other things can actually achieve greenhouse gas emissions. One thing about the Clean Fuels Program is it legally requires that the carbon intensity of fuels sold in Oregon decline 10% over 10 years. That's a legal certainty. When we look at the Dash 6 amendment, we're not sure that the projects that are contemplated there will necessarily result in greenhouse gas emissions. I think many of them might, but it's not a certainty, unlike the Clean Fuels Program, which legally requires that reduction in carbon intensity and the commensurate reduction in greenhouse gas emissions for transportation fuels. So I think we have a question about whether we're actually achieving some of the same results. But I'll finish by saying we want to be engaged in this conversation, and we will work very closely with Representative Vance and anybody else who wants to study these issues, and I thank you for the time.
Very good. Thank you. You know, committee, I'm going to, in order to make sure that Representative Vance has enough time to present, I'm going to ask both of you to stick around, and maybe after that presentation we could have questions on all these issues. So thank you for being here today. We appreciate the update. With that, I'll invite Representative Vance, Craig Campbell, and Mazen Malik up front. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Cliff Vance, State Representative, District 60. I'm joined by Mazen Malik and Craig Campbell. First of all, I want to thank the chair very much for giving us this opportunity. I really appreciate it. And it's a complex matter, and one that's extraordinarily important, I think, to our state, and well worth the time we're going to spend on it this afternoon. So thank you so much for that. And while I'm thanking people, I want to thank Palmer and Corianne for their patience with me in our many meetings, a lot of to-the-point discussions, a lot of opportunities for me to learn how little I know about this complex area. so I really appreciate their help. I also want to thank Maureen McGee for and down in LC for her work on these on these amendments. I think we're up to the dash 10, and we're still not done with this complex matter. She's been working on them right up until 2 hours before this hearing. So we were able to get three more of them on OLIS for you, but her work has just been invaluable and of a huge, huge help. And also, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you having the EQ go first. That was great. And part of my presentation is designed to illustrate how the thing works. So perhaps if we repeat it twice and then five times more, it'll start to soak in, maybe. So I want to mention something about my goal in all of this. Some people would say, I think I heard it when I was on OPB this morning, well, you Republicans want to gut the LCFS. That is not true. What we're anxious to do is to achieve CO2 reduction in an efficient way. Because when one looks into this issue of CO2, it's a serious matter. And it's not the type of thing that lends itself to simple solutions. It simply isn't. And for anyone to accuse me or any of my team of trying to destroy this, they are simply incorrect. What we're trying to do is figure out a way of measuring the outcome, measuring the challenge that this device presents to our economy and to our people. And this little PowerPoint I'm about to put on will illustrate that. Again, the goal here is to reduce CO2 in an efficient, effective way, and one that does not bankrupt those of us in this state. I want to point one other thing out. Yes, California is a test case, and thank goodness it's much larger than we are. It's ahead of us a couple of years, and so we can watch. I would say that my take on what's happening in California is slightly different than that which we heard from Corianne. But I'm sure it's a matter of how we present it, not the actual facts. So with that, Mr. Chair, let's get started. I want to thank folks back in my district for helping me put this together. My staff has been my staff has been hugely challenged with my impatience, and this is the result. So our concerns here are the impact on the transportation package, the impact on low-income Oregonians who drive cars, and the failure to achieve CO2 reduction at a rational cost. Those are our concerns with the LCFS. This little graph here shows one of my major concerns as a co-vice chair of the Transportation Committee. It's impossible to separate the challenges presented by the LCFS and the cost that goes with it from the very probable inclusion of an increase in the gas tax in the transportation package. So if you look at this graph, you'll see that the green part is the possible gas tax increase. We haven't decided on whether we'll even have one, but assuming we do, it would probably start somewhere near 5, 6, 7 cents, and it would then go up if we factor in inflation over the next 10 years by an amount. So the green line's the possible gas tax that might appear in a transportation package. The orange line is the LCFS. I took this line directly from DEQ's numbers previously presented a couple of years ago, that the impact over time would be between 4 and 19 cents. It does not mean that it will be 19 cents. That's why I put all those question marks at the end. I simply ran it up there as an illustrative device. And then you have to add those two together to get the red line. So if the LCFS ends up costing us 19 cents, I said if, and we add that to an increase in the gas tax, the total is somewhere near 34 cents. That is going to be a challenge to any Oregonian, and particularly to legislators trying to sell a transportation package. So what could we do? Here are three things. First, in this bill, 3386, we adopt a 75 per metric ton cost containment measure. You will recall from Corianne's presentation a few minutes ago, it did not appear that we reached that level. So one might say, well, why do we need this? Well, another way of saying it is, it shouldn't hurt. The second, it establishes a direct pathway to green investments, and finally, it provides transparency. Actually, 2481 provides transparency, and as Palmer pointed out, I don't think there's any objection to it. We need to talk about the LCFS. Proponents argue Oregonians will continue to drive liquid-fueled cars. I'm sure they're right. But we can only do this, as Palmer pointed out, the law requires that we achieve a 10% reduction in the CO2 in a gallon of gas. I want to remind everybody, if we achieve a 10% reduction, you still have 90% of the carbon. It's a 10% reduction. We still have 90%. So we could probably do better, and that's what this 3386 aspires to do. So by the numbers, how many cars in Oregon? 3.5 million. How many trucks are registered in Oregon? 34,000. How much gas do we burn? This did show up in small print on Corey Ann's presentation, 1.8 billion gallons of gas a year and 500 million gallons of diesel a year for a total of 2.3 billion gallons annually here in Oregon. That's a great big number, and that's the number to which the LCFS applies, 2.3 billion gallons. So beginning in 2015, the idea was let's force a 10% reduction in the carbon contained in those 2.3 billion gallons of fuel. And there you see the same chart that Corianne just showed us. So how do we do this? Well, right now, of course, the federal government requires that we blend a gallon of gasoline with ethanol, thus we get B10. That's the baseline for anything that we do here. The E10, that's where we start, that 90% reduction, 10% reduction. So this California test case, let's look at it for a second. They burn 18 billion gallons of gas a year. It's actually, I think, more than that now. That was a couple of years back, 18 billion. So beginning in 2010, they initiated their effort. There were some delays in it, and as a result, they had to reformulate their reduction path. They're going to see some very aggressive reductions in the next 3 years because they're trying to get where they want to go by 2020. Which is a 10% reduction. Last year, the cost to Californians was $630 million. It was 3.35 cents per gallon. And if you take that times 18 billion, you get 630 million. So that's what the people there spent. The cost is estimated to double next year. Argus Air, an outfit in California, does these studies and provided these numbers. I called them. I talked to them for an hour. Great folks. And this is what they said they thought would happen. So instead of the 3.5 cent cost per gallon, they think it'll go to 7. So this massive amount California is spending will lead to development of lower carbon fuel, we hope, because California is ahead of us in this. But if it doesn't happen, we'll run into the blend wall. And that is where we can't blend our way past to achieve the carbon reduction required by our LCFS law. So if that happens, what do we need to do? If we hit the blend wall, the cost of what little fuel does comply will skyrocket. Now, Palmer indicated that the law requires, quote, that we have a 10% reduction. What he left out is that there are already protections built into the law that allow it to be extended or otherwise modified or delayed. So the law is not going to be, you're all going to have to quit driving if we don't reach that level, because we can't allow that. We can't destroy our economy. We will change the law. And one of the ways that we are trying to address this possibility is through discussions about containing the cost in the event this program, well-meaning as it is, might go haywire. This cost containment concept, although not mentioned by Corianne in the presentation or Palmer, is being discussed right now in the DEQ's offices, in the meetings, the rulemaking on exactly this cost containment. The idea in this bill is to contain it at $75. Cost containment protects against crazy swings in the price of fuel, which ultimately damages not only the LCFS but the consumer. Just to show you that there is volatility, in the first three quarters of 2015, California's low carbon fuel credits increased by 212%. There's a chart. It's fallen down from that height of $120 to something closer to 80 right now, but as I indicated, anticipated to double. So what can you do if you run into the blend wall and can't blend your way to compliance? You can forgive the deficits. You can delay or postpone. So how much will this LCFS cost we Oregonians? According to the DEQ, between 4 and 19 cents, as I indicated earlier, at 19 cents times 2.3 billion gallons, it's $437 million a year. Now, we're talking real money. Now, I didn't see that number mentioned, although Palmer did allude to millions of dollars. He is right. At 19 cents, $437 million a year. And what are we getting? We're getting a 10% reduction in carbon, only a 10% reduction. We should aspire to something far greater than that. If it went up just 3 cents in Oregon, it'd be $77 million. So why not let the DEQ continue with its efforts to set the cost containment rules? The answer is because the DEQ is focusing on the same $200 a ton that California is focusing on. And this is probably more than rumored. If you read the materials, and I have, and talk to the folks involved, they would much rather that the cap was at $300 to $400 a ton to force serious change. That would drive the cost of fuel up 30 to 40 cents a gallon. And if Oregon follows suit, as some are asking, we'd be spending $920 million each year on our 2.3 billion gallons of fuel, almost $1 billion. So the alternative. We could be investing right now these monies in alternative fuel vehicles or R&D, and that's what 3386 does. This shows you kind of, this shows you how a lawyer draws a graph. This is what this shows you. And you can see the idea is that the fluctuating red line is the cost per ton of the LCFS. The black line declining downward is the declining standard. And, of course, yours at the bottom and 10% to the left. The money then from this credit device would go directly to low carbon activities. This, by the way, I didn't dream this up, although I can look at these two people next to me and mention that, was it in August, July of last year, we met and we met again and again and again trying to work something out. Mazin eventually came up with a penalty approach as an off-ramp. It turns out, though, this was already being discussed in California. So I thought Mazin was brilliant. I still do, Mazin. But the truth of it is California has already developed 5 solutions. They eventually went with a credit clearance approach if they encounter difficulties, and they chose not to go with the credit window, which I have selected here. I had been calling it the Mazin solution, but now I call it a credit window. Mazin, sorry. So we have an effective cap of $75 a ton through a credit window. This has been mentioned by researchers at UC Davis approvingly. They actually suggest the credit window. Now, they also have a cap and trade system in California, and they point at that as one of the reasons they are enthusiastic about this solution, not the credit clearance solution. So what happens? At the end of the year, the regulated parties can purchase credits for $75 each or purchase them less at the market. We just saw from Corianne's suggestion that perhaps we will never reach the $75. The $75, if we do get there, goes into NGOs. If, and I hope the unlikely event, we reach this level and everybody was buying credits for $75 a ton, we would end up with $184 million a year. I think this is what Palmer alluded to. And then that money would go to NGOs who would invest it in mass transit, alternative fuel vehicles, diesel chains out. I will tell you that Maureen McGee did a valiant job in trying to put in what we would invest the money in the DASH amendments that you have on OLIS. That is a great start, but by no means complete. So a lot of work needs to be done on what we might do with that money should we choose this approach. For purposes of this illustration, though, assume that we took some of that money and invested it in electric cars. The federal government, of course, already provides a $7,500 credit for electric cars. Let's pretend we added in a $5,001 from this source of funds, and people then begin to actually buy them. This would prompt 36,000 electric cars. Currently in Oregon, I think we have 4,000 electric cars. And this would bump us in that direction dramatically. If we want to drive true transformation, We could also add in funds out of the public purpose charge. This is not a new idea. We actually suggested it 2 years ago. For purposes of this illustration and one of the dashes, I've included it. It's much more difficult than my just saying it. But let's pretend we took half of the public purpose charge budget, which is $150 million a year. It's actually a little less than that. But we add it to $184 million. That'd be $259 million to go into electric cars. We could, if people took advantage of that program, transform 51,800 electric cars per year or alternative fuel vehicles. How much good does this do the environment? Instead of 51,000 cars creating 268,000 metric tons of CO2, we create just 34,000. That's 1 year. That's not over the 10 years that this would be in place, or I guess it would be eight now. So without direct investment, our fleet of 3.6 million cars will not transform. I want to show you this. This is a great illustration of how it's not working in California, and how, at least in 2014, our DEQ thinks it's going to work here in Oregon under the LCFS. The area on this graph to the left is the number of cars in California now, electric cars. And I think if you look, you'll see 2010 to 2016, these are California's market share of electric cars is up to 3.5%. It has not skyrocketed, notwithstanding the fact that they're just 3 years away from the end of their LCFS phase-in. This is what I think DEQ thinks Oregon's going to do when it comes to electric cars, just because of the LCFS. That's a pretty amazing assumption, isn't it? Without subsidies. That's why I'm suggesting that if we're going to achieve the outcomes that I think everybody's hoping for, keep in mind, if this happens, you can start counting all the credits from these. And that's what's going on in the assumptions made in the DEQ's presentation, that we'll have all of these things generating credits that will provide them the I call it a delay, but the offsetting use of non-clean fuel, because that's how those credits work. I would suggest that's a very, very optimistic assumption. I would also hope that that was done in 2014, 3 years ago. Perhaps it's changed. So what's our future? $437 million every year. It's probably going to be more, could be less. Going to whom, we're not sure. Or millions invested immediately in real CO2 reduction, protections of the consumer, real transformation. Not forget our package, which is right there. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to take questions.
Yes, and I'm going to take the chair's prerogative and ask the first question. Representative Bentz, will you consider doing my next PowerPoint presentation? Yeah, that was really one of the best ones I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Sorry. Committee, questions? Do your compadres here, are they just here?
They're free to weigh in any way they like. They've worked really hard on this, so they certainly deserve the opportunity.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to have your testimony if you're prepared to give some.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs. For the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And I thought I was good at PowerPoints until I saw this. Right? But just to kind of bring back to your attention, I think President Benz talked about a number of things. But let me remind you, the Legislative Revenue Office is a nonpartisan office that serves all of you whenever you need analysis and work on these things. And the Clean Fuel Standards Bill, when it came to Legislative Revenue as Senate Bill 324 and we looked at it, we gave that measure as an indeterminate impact. And an indeterminate impact usually does not come very often out of the legislative revenue because we try to either give it a number or not give it a number. But the way why we've done that at that time, because we couldn't really put our hands on a few things that we could pin down on that impact on transportation fuel in one sense and on other things. The first thing that and I'm sorry, I try to keep bringing this to mind, there is nothing in the bill, for example, or in the rules that says 10% greenhouse gas emissions. And the not only that, but those are actually in all of the reports that I got from DEQ, it's about the reduction is about 2.4, and in scenario 3 is about 2.8% reductions. Now, why do I mention that? Because we saw a lot of uncertainties in the program, and because of the uncertainties, we kind of issued our statement. The uncertainties come from a number of things, which is how do you transfer the fleet, and how do you change it from one point to another? Why is there an increase in CNG vehicles, for example, at this rate? Why is it an increase to other types of vehicles that uses different fuels? At which rates? For all of those, there was not really an answer that says we have a plan that we could pin our analysis on. But the highest level of uncertainty that we looked at was basically the 2020 and 21. Blending wall that was mentioned. That when we looked at this, so there is an assumption of a large transformation of the fleet from regular fleet into a very robust electric vehicle fleet, and that is a good thing to have. However, that assumes two things. That assumes a breakdown in one market, the fuel market, and an increase of supply in the electric market that actually pushes. I mean, people move because they get both pushed and pulled from one place to another, not only one. So the price we thought that is needed at that time would be very high, and that is definitely a risk for the program that you cannot assume that it, under normal assumptions, it will transition smoothly from one place to another. So that probably is one of the largest risks that we looked at. And as we were looking at this with Representative Benz, so there are ways that you could mitigate those risks by offering these different programs and ways of moving from one place to another. And I think that's behind the genesis of the idea. I'm not going to claim the author or the proud of ownership or authorship of this. California has obviously looked at these risks and that break up in the market, and how do you deal with this? And that in by itself, it just break down in the idea of a free market working enough quickly to adjust prices, and prices clear supply and demand and that kind of thing. So once you have that and you have these risks, I think if you basically, I liken it to putting a pressure valve on the engine. Once it starts building pressure and it, before it breaks down, if you let some steam out by opening a window or opening a ramp for these issues to happen, it will be a lot safer for the program to achieve its purpose. Thank you. That's
right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA. We had concerns about the low carbon fuel standard going in, and it's somewhat irresponsible when you have a concern about a program just to continue to harp on it but not provide any alternatives. So the idea was, especially since we knew trying to resolve concerns around the low-carbon fuel standard was going to be critical if we were going to be able to move forward a transportation funding package, we started into discussions about, okay, our members as an organization, our concern is that if by government action you're going to increase the cost of cars, two cars, that additional cost should really be used for the highway. That's a little variation on if you're going to impose a gas tax, then use the Constitution. Low carbon fuel standard is a little bit outside of that, but the concern was still there. So the idea was, how do you address our concern about increasing cost? And that was essentially making sure you had some sort of an effective cap. Looking at that 0 to 19 cent or 4 to 19 cent cost of the low carbon fuel standard, knowing that we are supportive of a concept of 11 cents for a transportation funding package. That leaves over about 8 cents to play with the low carbon fuel standard. $75 per ton equates to about an impact of 8 cents, and that's kind of the idea. But more than that, we could have just said, well, let's just cap it at $75 per ton. But that doesn't necessarily make sure you're doing anything positive for the environment. It just means you're capping the amount of money that can be used for credits. The idea was to provide a mechanism so that money would go to things that we knew would help reduce carbon emissions, things like encouraging research that would reduce Oregon-based transportation emissions, and then help enabling businesses to develop and produce those carbon-reducing technologies, also in the hope of exporting those, so that we're not just helping Oregon, we're helping other states as well. Also provide subsidies for the transformation from those who are currently not wealthy enough to purchase an electric vehicle to get rid of their carbon-emitting vehicles and move to an electric vehicle. And then finally, the idea that actually it came up in the discussions around the transportation forum, which is you have a lot of young people who live in districts where they can't take, they don't have a school bus system, so provide them with bus passes so they can get to and from school. But not only that, they can use it on the weekends so they don't have to resort to driving cars to get to and from school and wherever they go. And those are some ideas. Now, the thing is, those are just a few ideas to throw out. There are probably better ideas that could be used through the mechanism of the non-governmental entity to provide those $75 per ton credits. And you can use them for a wide variety of things. The other thing that it was designed to do is, one of our concerns is, if there's not enough credits that come into the market over and above that which is generated by the fuel mixing program, then you have a spike. So if you always make sure that there are credits available for purchase at a fixed price, you're not going to have that spike. And so that was the idea behind setting the price and making sure you always had an unlimited amount of credits at that amount. It may be they never get that high. If they don't, then this program isn't going to generate any revenue for these programs. But if it does, this is the mechanism that allows us to focus those dollars to something that we expect will have very specific reductions in carbon emissions, which is one of the reasons why we've been engaged in coming up with this alternative solution. I'd like to thank Representative Bentz for including us in that discussion and calling at all hours of day, night, weekends. I don't really know when he turns off, but I have not found that time yet. I'm looking forward to finding that out at some point in time.
All right. Thank you both for that testimony. Questions from the committee? Representative Power.
My question's for Representative Bentz. How I read through the Dash 6 amendments and didn't get a chance to see that there was a Dash 8, Dash 9, and now Dash 10. Can you walk me through how those differ from the Dash 6s? Or where any substantive differences exist in those?
Right. So thank goodness for Maureen McGee, because she gave me a summary of each of them, which I'm happy to share with you. You ask about the Dash 8?
Well,
nine,
I read the Dash 6s pretty thoroughly, because we had those this morning.
Right. So the Dash 8 is the all-inclusive bill that has in it the credit window. It has in the public purpose charge piece. It has the expedited review by the Supreme Court in the event that someone chooses to challenge this, as was mentioned by Palmer. If the Supreme Court determines that allocating money from credit sales into the NGOs is not constitutional, then that money would be redirected into the Green Road Funds. Actually, I call it the Transportation Emissions Reduction Account. And the idea there is that those funds would be used for things that drive down carbon creation on our transportation systems. That's in that bill, and it also incorporates the 2481-3 amendments, which are, is a transparency piece. So it has everything in it. The bill evolved as we worked with the various constraints that go with this kind of a complex piece of legislation. And I'm happy to share with you this summary. I'll share with everybody.
So. Further questions?
Yeah.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. I wonder, could be Representative Vince or whomever, but I want to get back to the Oregon-California relationship and the difficulty that full implementation in Oregon of the LCFS as planned for is made more difficult because we happen to be a neighbor to California that is slightly ahead of us, but obviously represents a scale of consumption at a level that this dwarfs us. Representative, could you just comment on that and the difficulty it presents for Oregon being able to have access for fuels and what that blending wall actually looks like as we get down the road another few years.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. The best, and I've asked that question of many people and many different answers. One of the answers is that if we had the same cap, then we would watch our fuel, even now, our so-called clean fuel being exported to California. That's happening as we speak. And if you talk to a number of the different groups that are creating clean fuel here in Oregon, you'll find that it's leaking away into California because the price down there is higher. And so we can anticipate a challenge when it comes to keeping that fuel here, as the price in California almost always is going to be higher as it is today. So you'll add the cost of the freight to California to the whatever the value is in California as compared to here, and away it'll go. And so what will that do? That'll have the consequence of driving up the cost of that type of compliant fuel in Oregon. So being next to you know, the elephant means that we'll share some of the difficulties. So that's one. There are others. Other folks have suggested that we're going to have an extraordinarily difficult time bringing fuel here that otherwise won't be diverted to California, and thus, again, driving up the cost of our fuel here. So not just that which might be created in the state going to California, but that which comes from outside going to California. So, yeah, it's a challenge. On the good side, we'll get to watch them as they go through these challenging meet the challenging standards they set for themselves. Thank goodness they're ahead of us.
Follow.
And I don't know if this is for you or for Mazin, but again, the LCFS envisioned, I think, transformative behaviors on the part of consumers moving from one fuel type that would become more expensive into something that would become less or involved no fuel, i.e. electric EV vehicles and so forth. But at what level of cost does it really take to make that transformation? I mean, I don't think 30 cents a gallon is enough to get somebody to, you know, ditch their junker and buy an EV. But Mazin, do you have any thoughts about at what level of cost would it have to get to really direct somebody to use the LCFS as the mechanism to inspire those sorts of changes and to get people into alternative vehicles versus those who just simply continue to pay the inflated price because they can't afford to go into something else?
President Johnson, I think if you recall, the Senate and then, of course, the House at one time wanted some of the answers like this about the price of carbon. They passed Senate Bill 306. They allocated $200,000 to us, and we did the study. I'm not asking for $200,000 to do the study, but what we're saying is these things are not easy to determine, and they're not easy to determine because you need to study this very difficult question. The problem is what we were looking at. There is no clear path of why the breakdown in this market, which is the fuel, and the breakdown meaning you cannot blend your way out of this anymore. So there is a point at which, and that's the blend wall, that blending might stop giving you the answers or the reductions in the intensity and still be usable in vehicles. That's not does not include diesel, but in gas vehicles in the same way. Unless, of course, there is a direct radical change in technology. Now, to assume that change in technology, it's I think in the documents that I saw, it assumes a big jump to electric market. But of course, it could be electric and it could be not. I mean, there is no way. Sometimes it is difficult and it's risky, in my opinion, in our work, to actually bet on which technology you're going to put your money on. This reminds me of the Betamax and the VHS. You know, which one was the right one to buy and which one to invest in? And Betamax was the upcoming technology that everybody wants to do. And they did it for a while, and then guess what? The winner was the CDs, neither the Betamax or the VHS. So it's that risk of saying that this technology or that will take care of that transformation after we had that blending wall, is that we said we really cannot look at this and say that we could score it in a way that actually puts numbers and dollars and cents on it in a way that satisfies this body.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, to add to that, and I'll probably get a little bit out over my skis here, but a few years back when the price of gas went up to about $4 a gallon, that was the first time we really saw any sort of a bending of the curve and people deciding to change their driving behavior. You started to hear the term staycation used, but that was almost entirely in discretional automobile use and really didn't drive anyone to using an alternative form of vehicle. Now, back then, electric vehicles were still fairly new and were still fairly expensive, as they still are today. But the general idea is that there are two ways you can approach changing the behavior of motorists when it comes to the carbon amount that they produce. One is you increase the cost of driving so high that they either choose an alternative form of transportation by transit, bike, ped, whatever that happens to be, or they change to a different technology, i.e. electric vehicles. But to do that, you have to increase the cost a great deal. And I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad approach if that's what you want to do. If you want to get people out of their cars, then using a mechanism that increases the cost to operate your motor vehicle is going to be one way to do it. It's not one that AAA supports, but that is a mechanism. And a program like a low carbon fuel standard, if it's allowed to raise the cost that much, might have that ultimate impact. So I think that was sort of the question you were asking. You're right in your assessment.
Any further questions, Representative Power?
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Malik. So as I was doing sort of the background research on this and understanding how the program got set up, correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that Oregon's mandated blend in gasoline is 10%. That's both a floor and a ceiling. I think that that's maybe the wall you're referring to. EPA, however, increased that blend floor in 2016, again in 2017. And some newer cars and flex fuel cars can accommodate greater than 10%. So why in your assumptions did you not, as we forecast out, also take into account that those parameters may change over time?
Vice Chair Power, I think what you've mentioned is absolutely correct. 10% is not the blending wall. I think it's more when you start going to the 15 and the 20%. Not because new technology is not coming to accommodate. I think, and obviously, no technology is emerging every day. The point is, in order for new technology to be transformational, in a big chunk of the economy, such as the fleet of vehicles, we have about 3.4 million cars. In order for that to transform in the short period of time that is given, meaning that you're not asking for new technology to only accommodate the new blend, you're also asking for the old cars to accommodate the new blend. And here where the risk comes, if these cars cannot here where comes the wall. And then the assumption is you need to move to a new technology, and you need to move to new technology very, very quickly. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that does not happen or it could not happen, because sometimes change happens very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And that in many places, either in societies or in economics or in science. However, that change in technology is difficult for us economists in that sense to predict and bank a transition of the fleet and the whole area and with an absolute certainty. What I've been suggesting to you is this is a risk of and a big uncertainty that we're not able to say, yes, the program will work like a clockwork in doing those. Yes, technologies are coming through, but you need that massive transformation that happens. Over 3.4 million vehicles. We sell and buy in Oregon about 120 to 125,000 vehicles a year. In order to transform all the or half of the fleet, imagine how many multiples that we need to start buying and selling in order to accomplish that. So that is an assumption that kind of leaves a little bit uncertainty in this whole picture that needs to be somehow mitigated. If you are trying to build a program, you at least want to put some allowance for those uncertainties to take place. I hope that helps.
Further questions? Representative Broxman. I'm going to try to get maybe two more questions in, five more minutes worth of questions, and then we need to go on with the folks that have signed up.
One more of a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I just wanted to thank our colleague, Representative Bentz, for this very informative and in-depth and concise work. It's brilliant, as I would come to expect, being the freshman on this committee. And it actually is very thoughtful in moving in a direction that would actually have an impact across the state into driving an impact that would be long-standing and moving people into Representative Barnhart's favorite conversation. And so he didn't catch my joke. And EVs. So I truly appreciate all of this great work and the presentation. I'll agree with the chair.
I'm going to go to Representative Reschke and then Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Benz, thank you. And just help me understand a little bit. These are clarifying questions. So currently with the LCFS, where does that money that's collected, where does it go? Does it stay in-state or go out-of-state?
I think it's safe to say we would not know. The whoever is selling fuel that meets that's lower than the standard, whoever's doing some activity that's lower than the standard is going to be ending up with credits. And in turn, the concept is that that they would use those credits to they'd sell them. And then the theory is make more low-carbon fuel. That's the theory. Okay. In point of fact, what's really happening is that there's a lot of fuel that exists not because of low-carbon fuel standard that's below the standard today. The idea is that would be sold and generate a huge bank of credits, and that's what Corianne was pointing out. Mm-hmm. Those credits are designed then to soften the blow when the standards fall. So in a way, it's kind of a delay tactic almost, where you can buy yourself freedom from standards for some short period of time in the future. But to say where exactly that fuel is coming from, I would say at California, 86% comes from out of state of California. 14% is manufactured in state. I would suggest very little is going to be manufactured here. It's not, we don't have the volume to create 2.3 billion gallons of fuel.
Then a real quick follow-up. So with your bill here, money being used, quote, is for R&D, would would that stay in Oregon, or do you see that being sent elsewhere?
Thank you for that question. The bill is designed to drive the R&D into our universities so that they can do the research necessary. That's a concept stolen from Roger Pielke, who wrote The Climate Fix, and he pointed out that we don't have a solution to the CO2 problem, and that the proper thing to do is get your economy cranked up, fund your universities better, have them figure it out, because we haven't figured it out yet. So that's the concept on that particular part of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Holden.
Thanks for the opportunity to ask a question. I got to admit, you were quite correct when you started out. This is really complex, and not having a tremendous amount of time to go through the Dash 6 or even consider further amendments beyond, just really trying to understand, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that are made, you know, in any analysis of this. And, you know, I think some of the assumptions may be debatable to start with. And so, you know, those assumptions are, you know, really important. So the amount of fees, you know, if we were to assume that we can use these fees eventually to redirect some of these monies to research, I think I'm reading that in the Dash 6, but I'm not totally positive. But it appears that some of the dollars are being directed towards research and sort of away from companies that are actually working on producing the fuels right now, the low carbon intensity fuels. And, you know, and so that seems like it's would slow down, I guess, your ability to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions just because you're redirecting that money to research. Not saying the research isn't important, but it seems like, you know, I'm not sure we can do that with the fees, and we, you know, how would we track or have accountable those companies that are now doing the research? And, you know, it just seems like us pulling out a big chunk of actually achieving the goals. And so I'm wondering, you know, where is it in here? I'm looking to see how are we actually making those reductions. You know, I understand that innovation happens, just like in going from the beta tapes to something new. But you know, it seems like it'd be odd for us to take the money out of actually working on the new fuels that are actually accomplishing the reductions to research that's not accomplishing those reductions.
Thank you very much for the question. Excellent question, by the way. And as you say, we're all victims of assumptions. And the initial assumption that one makes is that 10% reduction in fuel is actually going to save us. It's not. The only thing that's going to save us is finding a solution to the CO2 problem not yet existent. That's what's going to save us from the CO2 challenge we face. And so what happens is people hang up on the magic of the 10% reduction. It's a joke. It's a sad thing because it's not enough. Okay, but we're stuck with it. It's the law. So now the question is, how do we do the best that we can with it, salvaging it by putting the cap on it, keeping it in place? Corianne points out that the cost hasn't come close to $75 a ton. Thus, it will keep on working to achieve the purpose you just outlined. While at the same time, there may be a chance, if we hit that peak, to drive some money into what I hope would be finally a solution to the problem we face. But we don't just focus on that in the bill. There's five or six different places that money can be put. We will have to figure out a funding mechanism for DEQ because they, at the end of the day, will decide which of those NGOs enjoy funding. But thanks for the question.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the presentation. I'm going to move on to the rest of the folks that want to testify today. And I'm going to invite Tom Curler, Dan Koch, Ian Hill, and Brandon Price. And folks, we got 25 minutes left in the official time and six or seven people to testify, so
keep it quick.
Please. Yeah, I appreciate it. Introduce yourself by name before you begin speaking, and whoever's ready to go first.
Go first?
Yeah.
Okay. Daniel Cook, I'm the plant manager at our Pacific Ethanol facility. Chair Helm, members of the committee, I'm here to testify in the opposition of House Bill 3386. Rolling back the Clean Fuels Program in Oregon will not only affect our long-term climate change goals, but also have a negative economic impact on the region. The facility in Boardman began operations in August 2007 and has remained in operations ever since. The facility has 36 full-time employees who earn a living wage, as well as supporting additional jobs at a connected CO2 capture facility. We also support the ongoing employment of over 20 truck drivers who drive roughly 800 hauls a month from our facility for regional deliveries. Our plant proudly supplies a connected third-party CO2 plant, which provides a local option for cold storage and bottling plants in the region. This process further helps to close the loop of our facility. The state of Oregon's support for clean fuels has allowed us to survive, invest, and expand at our facility, and continued support will allow us to further invest and expand, creating more jobs in rural Oregon. We have a deep and personal understanding of Oregon's unique position. Over the past several years, as Pacific Ethanol has made decisions about investing new capital at our plants, we've invested most heavily in our California operations and specific technologies and our improvements that reduce the carbon intensity of our product. Why? It's because the market for cleaner, low-carbon fuels is secure in California under its low-carbon fuel standard. The market there has developed to the point where our customers seek and pay for transportation fuels based on its carbon score. With these process technologies, we are producing a superior product that is good for our customers and for the communities in which the plants operate. We know that we can make similar incremental investments to achieve the same in Oregon, but we need the regulatory certainty that the Clean Fuels Program can provide. Rolling back the program will create an element of uncertainty that Pacific Ethanol must consider when choosing where it will make ongoing investments. I've heard from some that there's a blending wall in the market which will create natural shortages of ethanol. As the market for low-carbon fuels stabilizes and the threat of legislative gutting of the program goes away, we will see investments in technologies to continue to lower carbon intensity. Ethanol already has a nationally approved blend rate of up to 15%, and auto manufacturers are producing cars to be fully warrantied at these higher percentages. A blend wall does not exist, and it is not a problem today or into the future. Without clean fuel options, Oregonians are sending more than $6 billion out of state each year to import gas and diesel. By capturing even just a small fraction of those fuel dollars and keeping them here at home, we can create thousands of jobs and have a significant impact on our local economy. I urge you to oppose House Bill 3386. Clean fuels in the long term is good for rural Oregon.
Thank you. Tom Curler, I'm co-founder with Pacific Ethanol. We do have the unique advantage of actually having plants both in California and in Oregon. Our plant in Oregon represents somewhere around 25% of the fuel ethanol consumed in Oregon. And I wanted just to reemphasize the point, Representative Power, you made about the blend wall, because it does not exist. EPA has a fuel allowed for up to 15% ethanol for cars of 2001 and newer. So a minor tweak to the fuel regs here in Oregon that would match what's going on in Washington and really across the country would take care of that, and I would urge that tweak. Also, just got back from Detroit, sitting down with all the auto companies, and they're focused on electric vehicles, and in addition, they're focused on high octane, high compression engines, and the cars that they're going to start making require a octane of 100. Ethanol has an octane of 115. So we're going to start seeing cars made by the auto manufacturers that would utilize somewhere between 20 to 25% ethanol. We think that the a market mechanism like the LCFS is what it takes to transform the transportation sector. Nobody can predict how it's going to go, and we ought to let the market work, and we support the current program as is. Thank you.
Brandon Price with Clean Energy Renewable Fuels. Chair Helm, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to submit comments. Clean Energy operates the largest infrastructure of natural gas fueling stations across the country, and we do operate an LNG station here in Oregon. It's our Central Point LNG station where we actually deliver renewable natural gas to right now. We have also partnered with Fred Meyer as an RNG customer here in Oregon, in addition to Republic Services. So we are a strong advocate of the DEQ's current form of the low carbon fuel standard. And we believe that the current amendment would throw a lot of uncertainty into a market, which makes investment in further projects, it threatens investment in further projects. The projects that we're building across the country are very capital intensive, and we rely on market certainty to go ahead and secure financing. And without a stable market to deliver into, those projects really turn in question. We've already seen that in one case here in Oregon. There at the Port of Morrow, there is a food waste biogas project in the works right now who has secured the first round of financing, but uncertainty in the market has prevented any further financing from coming through, and this is something that we want to prevent. We're talking about investment in R&D and technology. We have the technology available now. In the heavy-duty trucking sector, Clean Energy has been a huge proponent of the new ultra-low NOx engine put out by Cummins Westport. We believe that partnered with renewable natural gas is the cleanest on-road heavy-duty application for long-haul trucks, and that technology is available today. So it's something that we need to incentivize more and more of RNG production across the state, across the country, and stable LCFS programs is, you know, stable LCFS programs is what's going to lead us to that point. We've seen considerable growth in volumes over the last 5 years. Just last year, Clean Energy Renewables alone delivered 60 million gallons of RNG, up from 50 million gallons the year before, and this year, 2017, we're slated to do another 75 million. This is slated to grow, like again I said, with partnerships that we've already made, and with converting fleets from diesel to natural gas, a lot with, you know, using the new technology available in the Cummins Westport engine. So I would just urge the committee to reevaluate this amendment and to allow, you know, private investment to continue so that we can continue the traction that we have seen to this point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. Chair Helm and members of the Energy and Environment Committee. For the record, my name is Ian Hill, and I'm a co-founder of Sequential. We are Oregon's only producer of biodiesel, and we're the longest running commercial producer of biodiesel on the West Coast. I've submitted longer testimony in a written format, and for the sake of time, I'll keep my oral testimony to a minimum. Something not included in my written testimony, but an issue that I've heard raised here today, and to piggyback on what Mr. Curler said earlier regarding the blend wall, it may not be known to you, but credits generated in the diesel side of the program can be applied to deficits created on the gasoline side. I don't think anyone that has looked at any of the forecasts would argue that on the diesel side we have ample opportunity and really no issue achieving credit generation to cover the needed the deficits that will be accomplished by the program. And so those credits, those surplus credits generated on the diesel side through biodiesel, RNG, renewable diesel, et cetera, can be applied on the gasoline side. So that helps with the issue, and I would agree that it's a somewhat fictitious issue of the blend wall, but an important point there. And then finally, to note, our company grew out of a garage as an idea from a couple of University of Oregon students to a company now that has 150 employees here in Oregon. We operate in 5 states. Here in Oregon, we do business in just about every county in the state. And we're interested, eager, and excited to continue investing here in Oregon. But we need policy certainty to do that. And just this bill alone is actually creating a dampening effect in the trading of credits with the Oregon Clean Fuel Program right now. Because we're living and breathing that every day. We're credit generators. We're out in the market trying to sell those. And just having this conversation, this bill being heard and brought up, is dampening that effort today. It's having a real effect. So I thought that was worth presenting to the committee. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you. Okay.
We've got time for a couple of questions here, but I want to make sure we get to the final panel as well.
So, panel too.
Yeah, one more. So, questions, Rep. Holvey, and then Representative Brocksmith.
Yeah, and maybe for Mr. Hill. Just looking at this largely and listening to what you're talking about, the certainty of the program now that we sort of heard from DEQ, the program seems to be working, but it's very, very early. Do your sales show, continued increased volume of biodiesel specifically? I mean, seeing that that's generating some success in reducing our emissions, I would assume it does because you're displacing regular diesel. Mm-hmm. So is your business seeing that increased demand in Oregon?
Absolutely. And we have the benefit of other programs here in Oregon that have helped us develop the largest network of high blend retail stations in the country is actually here in Oregon. And we continue to see that grow.
And just a follow-up, and so when you're looking at the House Bill 3386-6, how is it that that is actually going to disrupt, I guess, your continued sales of biodiesel in Oregon that's causing you this concern?
Well, by creating a low cap in the market, which is, and I don't have the privilege of knowing all the amendments. I think I'm up to -6 as well.
That's as far as I've gotten.
Yeah.
So.
It will tend over time to push market demand into states that potentially have higher credit prices and greater certainty. Also, I would say that the way the program is structured now, it's actually, credits are only generated by companies that are producing fuel that has low carbon, right? And so by the money that is generated by the program going back to those companies, it's helping to increase the production, to increase innovation, and further reducing the carbon of that fuel. But if we start to take some of that money and siphon it off into research and development and other programs, while those are worthy and we would actually support those in a different format, it reduces the effect to companies like ours that are actually making, in our case, extremely low carbon fuel.
Thanks.
Representative Brocksmith.
I'll just follow up on this line of questioning. Thank you. But the whole purpose is to limit reductions overall. And so the other piece of this plan is to drive it into the EV market, which reduces even more carbon emissions than you can in your business. Is that not true?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand the question. The diesel... largely, diesel volume is not seen to be displaced heavily by electric vehicle. I think that would be more on the light duty side, largely. I'm not sure if that's your.
But the overall goal of this program is to reduce emissions across the board, okay. And so if we can reduce those emissions across the board by utilizing these and then driving folks into, because we've had discussions in prior committees about electric vehicles and the wave of the future and how we need to invest in those. But I see this as as almost, I mean, your company exists by creating the credits and then, correct? I mean, you create a lower emission fuel,
right,
as you just mentioned, and then you trade the credits and or sell the credits to folks that need to buy them because they are utilizing fuel that isn't, that produces a lot of carbon. Correct.
Correct.
Okay. And so, if this process can limit the and take those credits, if you will, but those dollars that are subsidizing your company and drive them into an AV market, I think we could lower over the overall cost of emissions. But secondly, you mentioned private investment. I'm going to the next person. Forgive me.
I need to wrap up pretty quick, though. Okay.
Thank you.
Quickly.
So how much of... How many locations do you currently provide, fueling stations you're currently provide in the state?
Here in Oregon?
Yes.
Right now we're providing it to 4 different locations currently.
Gotcha.
But as DEQ pointed out in their presentation earlier, there is a significant amount of growth in CNG, vehicle fueling infrastructure, and just... one of the initiatives we're taking down in California is replacing over 10,000 diesel trucks at the Port of Long Beach and converting them all over to the Cummins low NOx engine. That would create significant demand, and that's something we would also like to see here in Oregon, replacing the diesel trucks with the lower NOx natural gas engines. So creating that demand here as well and having that traction and having a stable LCFS market will help us to build more plants to procure more renewable natural gas to bring in.
Thank you all for your testimony and being here today. I hope you can stick around. I'm going to try to have the next panel, and then if there are other questions, I might invite people back up. So thanks again for being here. And I'll invite up next Jana Gastelum and Scott Hedrick. And then Janice Thompson as well. And while you're coming up, I need to go ahead and carry over the work session on House Bill 2111 until Monday, April 10th. If we have listed here a Mr. Chris Bush that is a call-in, is that part of your panel show?
He can be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't I let you all make that decision? We can certainly get him on the phone right now if it's your desire to do
that. Most convenient for you.
Okay. Why don't we have your testimony and see what questions arise. So, Jana, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Chair Helm, co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm the Climate Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. I'm here in opposition to HB 3386 and its various amendments. We haven't had a chance to review the latest as well. We've been open to having conversations and looking to review language for quite a while now, so we appreciate the opportunity to provide comment, but want to reserve the opportunity to provide additional comment as we have more time to look at the amendments. So the Clean Fuels Program, as you've heard, is working. Diverse fuel options, but for a Clean Fuels Program, Fred Meyer wouldn't be using biogas. You're seeing innovation, and clean fuel jobs are expanding in Oregon. And there's an old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's why the legislation today seems problematic and premature. The first issue that I would say we would raise is from an environmental standpoint is that what is being proposed, what is currently in the program is that it is a very quantifiable, measurable program. Every tank of low-carbon fuel that is used in Oregon produces emissions that are real, that benefit Oregon here. They those tanks produce those credits for compliance in the program. What is being proposed, on the other hand, is a simple payment that doesn't correlate and, in fact, requires no real emissions reductions in the state. From an implementation standpoint, when do you decide that a credit is generated? At the beginning of a research project? At the end of a research project? What happens if that research project doesn't bear any fruit? We need these real emissions reductions, and we need them now. And this isn't just a matter of simple climate benefit, but also the clean air quality benefits that are important. We have a lot of people who live, work, play near busy roadways. My child goes to a daycare center that is very close to a daycare. So this isn't just a matter of a paper credit game. This is about real benefit to real people here in Oregon and a really important climate strive for our state. So allowing this unlimited number of these paper credits undermines that market demand for clean fuels here in Oregon. It's no longer clear how much demand there will be, and that means that there's greater uncertainty, as was alluded to before. Try going to get a loan on a project and say that maybe you might be able to sell clean fuels here in Oregon. And these paper credits have a much lower standard of entry. Again, there's no reduction requirements required for that credit generation. We've been part of the DEQ stakeholder process looking at cost containment and good consumer protection. We believe in protecting consumers as well as protecting the climate. As part of this process, there were a series of principles developed to say good cost containment should do the following: build rather than undermine investor confidence, align with regional programs so that we don't disadvantage Oregon's market, we shouldn't stifle innovation, and additionally, because we've seen so many different versions of these amendments, including the first one that was quite different, we also think it's important to register for the record that none of these should be able to be easily manipulated by regulated parties, as was the original draft of 3386 that was quite problematic. And then it should uphold the goals of the program to quantifiably reduce emissions here in Oregon. I want to just comment on a couple of the slides that were presented on the compliance scenarios. So regarding electric vehicles, just want to correct the record. There are actually about 13,000 electric vehicles in Oregon, not 4,000. The program already allows investment in electric vehicles. In fact, in California, you're seeing utilities are offering rebates for electric vehicles. The EV assumptions that are presented are actually driven by the zero emission vehicle standard that is already federally required, or Oregon has adopted those standards. So those projections are based on the ZEV mandate. They're not just picked out of thin air. And in addition, some of the compliance scenarios actually had quite conservative estimates for what the electric vehicle population would do. They assume, for example, that the plug-in electric vehicles at a maximum over the next 10 years would get about a 40 mile charge for the plug-in vehicles. Today, we're seeing plug-in vehicles that get a 50-mile charge. So some of what you see having been modeled out that was presented by Representative Bentz actually are quite conservative estimates. So we would expect to see benefits beyond what was simply modeled. We are also concerned about the constitutionality questions of this program. If indeed dollars are diverted out of the clean fuels marketplace only to land in the Highway Trust Fund, we don't think that that is the intended outcome of the clean fuels program. And we are very concerned about the lack of quantification of what the climate benefits of this type of amendment would be. I also want to just add to the record on 2481, we've had the benefit of talking with gas station owners and other retailers who are participating in the clean fuels program. John Anderson with Truck and Travel in Eugene, we asked his opinion on this, and he did say that the gas tax receipt idea was a burden on small business operations to change receipts. The added step increases the burden on us for a receipt that most people don't even look at, and it's quite frankly a waste of time. The information printed on the receipts may not even be relevant to a gallon of gas being purchased that day. The information could be a year old. And what about all the benefits? Where is the state demanding that those get shared with the public? The bottom line is that these changes to the Clean Fuels program will erode demand for clean fuels in Oregon, guarantee the program doesn't significantly reduce climate pollution or air pollution, undermine the credit market, stifle innovation, be very difficult to implement, and is likely unconstitutional. The program is working. Let's let it keep working. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good late afternoon. My name is Scott Hedrick. I'm director of corporate affairs for a company called Renewable Energy Group. We are based in Ames, Iowa. We are North America's largest producer of biodiesel, the second largest producer of renewable diesel. We have 12 plants in North America. As of January, we have two plants that we've acquired in Germany. We produce over 500 million gallons of biodiesel. That's half a billion. That represents about one quarter of the national consumption for 2016. We do have a plant that is unfortunately not based in Oregon, the same as I think oil refineries are not based in Oregon. Mm-hmm. But we do have a plant that is in Washington State in Grace Harbor, and we do ship a significant amount of product here, and we like to think that the folks that we employ who bring it down are receiving a good income and continuing to work for being part of that that stream. I'd like to talk about two things, and then I know it's late. I'll try to be quiet and let the committee move on. And they have to do with elephants. There's an Asian proverb, and I apologize if it's Indian or where in Asia, but it talks about if you're going to eat an elephant, you have to take several bites. And I think the implication is if you take one giant bite, you're going to die. And secondly, there's a proverb about if you close your eyes and put your hand on an elephant and try to describe it, what are you describing? And so depending on where your hand is, it could be on the tail, it could be on the tusk, you're going to describe something very interesting. But it doesn't represent the elephant as a whole. And I think both those analogies could be applied to HB 386, which our company opposes. I'll also add that we have a lot of concerns with 2481 as well. I'll just reference my colleague's comments about if we're going to print the cost, we should print the benefit. In terms of the elephant analogy, I appreciate Representative Bence's efforts. I think that in political discourse today, it's too easy to throw stones from the other side and not listen to what folks are saying. And I appreciate his concerns about where the program could go in the future. But unfortunately, I think that the data that has been used is a little bit old, certainly outdated, and the assumptions not updated for where we are today. There are lots of fuel opportunities before we ever get to EVs that could readily meet on the diesel side Oregon's needs. Our company produces one renewable diesel. It's a drop-in fuel. It's a fuel whose growth in production in the U.S. is double digits. It's nowhere near where we are on the petroleum side for sure, but it's a renewable fuel that's been growing rapidly. There are lots of opportunities for the fuel market that exists today to step up. I think we have stepped up. As I said, our plant in Grace Harbor ships a significant amount of product to Oregon. We purchased that plant 2 years ago, specifically with Oregon, Washington, and California in mind, and our production out of that plant pretty much equally goes to all three states. I guess I'll just wrap up in saying that there are already existing off-ramps, existing cost containment discussions, existing programs within the LCFS that address the needs that HB 3386 purport to. I don't know that the time is ripe for this kind of legislation. I think that we need to see the process through. It's still in its infancies in Oregon, as was stated repeatedly. And I think that if the legislature can have the patience to let the executive branch and the agencies involved do what they've been tasked to do, and then if need be down the road, step in. But in the interim, let them do what they're supposed to do. We'll see that the program is going to be able to deliver benefits back to the residents of the state. Thank you.
Janice Thompson, Advocacy Director with the Oregon Citizens Utility Board, or CUB. CUB does not support the damaging changes to the Low Carbon Fuel Standard Program due to these amendments. This general opposition is linked to CUB's participation in the clean fuels rulemaking underway at DEQ. We were invited to that rulemaking process to ensure kind of a consumer protection voice. Many of the rulemaking discussions have focused on little guy consumer protection, and in that setting, CUB is advocating for options that both protect individual Oregon consumers and provide program benefits. And we're confident that the rulemaking process will yield good results that meet both those program goals. Regarding just a quick review of the Dash 8 and Dash amendments, CUB opposes diverting public purpose charges. CUB supported Senate Bill 1149 that established that effort for energy efficiency investments and renewable energy programs. These dollars come from a surcharge paid by ratepayers of Portland General Electric and Pacific Power. And instead of each of these utilities creating kind of the duplicative programs, the ETO was also created an entity that's subject to rigorous oversight by the Oregon Public Utility Commission. So in other words, this is ratepayer money that's being suggested to be diverted, and though those are major utilities, they do not serve all Oregonians, and it's inappropriate then to redirect these dollars from these collected from the service areas of these utilities to a statewide program. Indeed, such a diversion seems likely to run afoul of the Uniform Taxation Clause of the Oregon Constitution. And just over and above the legal concerns, there just seems to be a basic principle of fairness that's violated by using money from ratepayers in one part of the state for programs outside those utility territories. And then a second point of opposition is that there will be increased costs to ratepayers if these PGE and Pacific Power ratepayer dollars are diverted from their intended purpose used by the ETO, both for above-market component of renewable energy projects and for energy efficiency efforts. Energy efficiency opportunities continue to be cost-effective and is just the cheapest bargain around with many environmental and other benefits. Energy efficiency opportunities, these investments save ratepayers money over and above the surcharge because they mean that these utilities do not have to purchase more expensive electricity. And to be clear, the benefits don't just go to the customers involved in certain projects in partnership with the ETO. There are system-wide benefits to all customers. For every $1, for example, that ETO invests in energy efficiency, all ratepayers save $3. So the bottom line is, if these public purpose dollars from ratepayers are not used for their intended cost-effective renewable and conservation projects, their rates will go up. So there's for that reason, CUB certainly does not support, we have a general opposition, but are particularly concerned by those features of at least two of the amendments, and we urge no further action.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Yeah.
Representative Broxman.
Sir, thank you so much for your testimony. Does your company generate any revenue from the credit system that currently exists?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. But your, sorry, follow up. Your company's based out of where?
So our headquarters is in Ames, Iowa, and our West Coast plant is in Washington State. I guess I'd also point out, I don't know that any of the in-state oil refineries are probably generating credits from the program either. So
I have a question for Scott before we move on. Share with us your thinking as a business person. As the credit price ascends toward $75, toward the cap, what does your thinking as a business person, what is it? And then what happens when the cap is hit and exceeded?
So I think as we look at our business model, we've invested as a company over $100 million the last 5 years in existing plants. In Grace Harbor, we haven't invested quite that much. It's been about $8 million in the last 2 years. I mentioned in my testimony that there's already next generation fuels that are coming into the marketplace. One is renewable diesel. It's a very capital intensive plant to build, and we're looking at options on the West Coast to build one. When we look at this legislation, that's a broad sign that Oregon might not be ripe to locate. That's the bottom line. It doesn't provide a mechanism to deliver lower carbon options for residents of the state long term. It's a mechanism to short circuit the program before it ever begins. If we're going to invest $300 million, we want to know that the state that we're going to invest in is going to support policy for the long haul. You don't make an investment that big and turn it on or off 2 or 3 years down the road. So it's a chilling sign. I know it's not meant and intended to be one, but it's a chilling sign.
Representative Betts.
Thank you. I don't think you got an answer to your question. Well, he asked you what's going to happen when the price of the credit goes up, and you didn't answer. What I think he was trying to ask you is, will the people of Oregon pay more for fuel as the price of credits goes up? I think that's what he's asking.
Yeah, I think,
to put a finer point on it, I believe it was suggested by a member of your panel that the better limit for these credits would be $300 to $400, not just $200. And why would that be? And what are the consequences of those higher credits? Much more attractive to you, of course. You're making money.
Yes.
What does it do to those who are paying for it? That's what his question was. Can you answer that question?
Sure. So I think.
Wait. Just to be fair, that wasn't my question. It's a good question. I'm happy to have the answer. My question was more along the lines of, it seems like the system will continue to work as it is now up to about $75, and then beyond $75, the incentive to continue to invest in Oregon evaporates. And so that's what I was trying to get an answer out of. So, But I'm happy to have your question answered.
Mr. Chair, you are saying the incentive evaporates, but what's the incentive if not the possibility of getting more than $75? That's what he's supposed to be addressing.
I think we're getting at the same thing.
I think we are. Let's listen to the answer. It should be interesting.
So I think when you get to the $75 cap, what you're going to see is Oregonians don't receive as much carbon reduction as the LCFS would have required. Our company is still going to participate in the marketplace. Companies that are here are still going to participate in the market, just the same way oil companies are going to participate in the marketplace. As long as citizens have vehicles, as long as trucks have heavy vehicles that goods need to be delivered, we'll participate. But if the question is, will Oregonians receive the reduction in carbon loading and the impact of climate change? The answer is, I don't think so.
Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
It's irksome when we don't get an answer to a question. And as a lawyer, I get irked easily, so forgive me. But the question was, what will happen, at least my question was, if the price of a credit is higher than $75, let's say $200, will the people of Oregon be paying more than would be the case if the price was as it is today, somewhere around $3 or $4?
Sure. Well, as a lawyer,
that's my question.
Sure. As a lawyer, I think you understand that hypothetical questions are difficult to answer. So if you look at the marketplace in California where it's gone to a maximum of $130, the impact back to citizens has been less than a penny and a half, I believe, according to CARB.
So it's more. Hallelujah.
Mr. Chair, this is not being productive, so I think I'm done asking questions. Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to move on to our last group. Thank you for all of your testimony and being here today. Brian Doherty, Max Miller, and Christine Everts. And that's our last panel for today. Brian, go ahead if you're ready.
Thank you. Chair Helms, members of the committee. Brian Doherty here testifying on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association. First off, I do want to thank Representative Bence for the enormous contribution he's put into this and the amount of time he's put into it. Just to point out, I ask any of you to ask him what a megajoule is, and you will find out he knows that granular detail in this program. And he, like I, have found out this is a terribly complex program, very hard to deal with. As you know, we've opposed the LCFS when it started. We believe it is the highest priced, lowest carbon benefit program you can pick. And we've talked about that, but now we're dealing with the LCFS as it's in here. And I want you not to be confused between a 10% CI reduction and what you're getting for greenhouse gas reduction. You're getting about 1% of Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction if you get to 10% carbon intensity reduction. So this is not a program that's giving you a lot of benefit for the cost, as Representative Bence showed. Cost containment. Cost containment is the third pillar. You heard Palmer Mason say that the pillars of the low carbon fuel standard was to do LCF or carbon reduction and to have lower carbon vehicles and fuels. The third thing, it's in House Bill 2286 from 2009 and in Senate Bill 324, was cost containment. And that's what we presented in 3386. And we support 3386. Let's talk just briefly about what 3386 does. It has a short-term trigger. If prices of the credits spike over a 1 or 2 month period, you can pick a percentage. It was in there 25% or 40%. But that's an anomaly in the market that will have consumer cost concerns. And it doesn't kill the program. It says pause it, put it back, have DEQ look and DEQ go back, but figure out why is that happening. Those are major spikes that can happen when you have credit shortages or something like that. We want to look forward on credits, look forward on fuel availability, so we don't run into these credit spikes. But it has a credits clearance market, just like California. It is another market in which you try and true up and get this market working. So there is no killing effect of this. It simply is dealing with price spikes, price marks, and we have a price cap. I'll get now to dealing with the Dash 6 amendments. And I appreciate Representative Bence has always been on the right place on this about talking about consumer costs. And you need to tie this to a transportation package. What are you bringing home to the folks in your district? I have concerns, and I at this point oppose the methods that Dash 6 does because of not the $75. In fact, if you want to put the 3386 and change it to $75, you could have the same effect. He's trying to lower the cost of this program to Oregon consumers in order for a transportation package to fit within this. And that can be done with 3386 as well. Why are we concerned with the Dash 6 amendments? It's the NGOs that's going to and what they do. And when we buy biodiesel or ethanol, and by the way, we've been buying from everybody that's been testifying up here, we know exactly the carbon reduction we got out of that purchase. So we know the carbon number. We won't have that in something like transit bus passes to kids. We won't know it. We may know it in terms of low-income people that buy if they're switching from a car. If they're not switching from an older car to that, how do you know? How do you know what R&D does? Everybody can remember Cascade Grain and Klatskanite that got $37 million in loans and Betsy credits and closed their doors 6 months after opening. We have the same thing with Zchem and Borbnin, trying to do cellulosic. You heard since 2006 we've talked about cellulosic. It's never come to fruition. You can't make a commercially viable product there. It hasn't come to date. And DEQ's not even including it in their areas. So here we're going to be having one industry funding its competitors and have in some, maybe we'll get something in R&D. I don't disagree with R&D. on doing it. I disagree that this is the way you should fund R&D and put it on the other industry. So finally, I'll just say again, thank you for letting me testify. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I think there's a lot more to discuss on this, and I look forward to do that and try and make a better bill. Thank you.
Max, go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair Hellman, members of the committee. My name is Max Muller, and I am testifying today on behalf of the Union of Concerned Scientists. On behalf of the Union of Concerned Scientists, 11,000 supporters in Oregon, I really appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill today. UCS has been very involved in the creation of clean fuel standards at the federal and state level for many years, including the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard, which, by the way, has been very successful. And just to illustrate that point, between 2011 and 2015, the use of alternative fuels in California grew by 31%, while the average carbon intensity of these fuels declined by 21%. And during that time, carbon emissions were reduced by 16.8 million tons overall. So the low carbon fuel standard in California is working well. Our Oregon members strongly supported 2015's reauthorization of Oregon's Clean Fuels Program as a way for the state to create new industries and jobs from homegrown sources of fuels while diversifying fuel supplies to reduce reliance on price volatile imports. And of course, the program is also an important step in cleaning Oregon's air, improving public health, and in reducing global warming pollution. UCS opposes HB 3386 because the proposal deviates fundamentally from the Clean Fuels Program's goals by allowing obligated parties to continue to use the same highly polluting fossil fuels as before, so long as they pay a fee. While the purposes to which these funds could be put are notionally related to reducing global warming pollution, they depart from the rigorous science-based carbon accounting on which the Clean Fuels Program is based. Grants for student transportation and grants for research on loans for manufacturing of and rebates for alternative fuels may be aimed at worthy goals, but there is no guarantee that using funds for these purposes will actually reduce pollution or by how much. Since the use of these funds may be unconstitutional, the fee this bill generates may ultimately be sent to the Highway Trust Fund, where if they're used for road expansion projects, it would make the prospect of earning emissions reductions from these fees even more dubious. UCS is concerned that the bill's creation of an alternative compliance pathway would fundamentally undermine the Clean Fuels Program's functioning. By design, program participants already have several compliance options, including producing or acquiring a wide range of a wide variety of low-carbon fuels, or purchasing credits from others who produce or use these fuels. The program also allows credit banking, which provides additional flexibility. The bill would circumvent the deliberate and thoughtful process that is already underway at the Department of Environmental Quality to develop an appropriate cost containment strategy. The DEQ is currently in the process of this rulemaking to develop a cost containment mechanism for the program. This adds to other regulatory measures that are already in place to cap compliance costs, address shorter long-term scarcity of low-carbon fuels, and to assure that DEQ can anticipate and act if necessary to address any unforeseen problems. All of these measures have been developed to support a predictable transition to clean fuels while protecting Oregon consumers and balancing the legitimate concerns of clean fuels buyers and sellers. In this rulemaking process, all stakeholders, and UCS is one of them, have been able to weigh in with their concerns and fully vet the implications of proposals from DEQ and other stakeholders. Lastly, one last point. At best, the $75 per ton compliance credits that are envisioned in this bill would be an unreliable funding mechanism for any program that depends on them. And that's because it's entirely possible that the Clean Fuels Program's credit prices will stay below $75 a ton for the duration of the program, in which case direct compliance would be the lowest cost compliance strategy, and no funds would be generated for research, manufacturing, student transportation, or alternative fueled vehicles. If funding for these programs is generated, it would remain unpredictable. As policies outside of Oregon's market, for example, federal fuels or vehicle policies could lead credit prices to fall. Grants for research and other low carbon transportation goals are always more effective if they have stable and predictable sources of funding. So in this way, we believe the bill undermines the stability of support for low carbon fuels without providing stable support for the other goals contained in the bill. UCS believes that allowing the regulatory agency, DEQ, to continue its ongoing rulemaking is the most appropriate way to refine the details of the Clean Fuels Program, and it does so without undermining the legislature's overarching goals for the program. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Great.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. I'll keep my remarks very brief in the interest of time. For the record, my name is Christine Everts, representing the Northwest Energy Coalition, and I'm here to register concerns regarding a very specific potential aspect of House Bill 3386 related to the public purpose charge. The Northwest Energy Coalition is an alliance of nearly 100 environmental, civic, and human service organizations, progressive utilities, and businesses in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and British Columbia. We promote development of renewable energy and energy conservation, consumer protection, low-income energy assistance, and fish and wildlife restoration on the Columbia and Snake Rivers. We understand there are various versions of House Bill 3386, namely the Dash 8 and Dash 10 amendments, which would divert funds from the public purpose charge. These dollars are paid for by utility customers and must directly benefit utility customers. The public purpose charge reduces energy costs for electricity consumers, contributes health and safety benefits to homes and businesses of utility consumers, and reduces environmental impacts of electricity generation, including reducing greenhouse gas reductions, which lowers the long-term financial risks for the utility system associated with these liabilities. Further, the public purpose charge is fully expended on these items. There is no room for additional expenditures under current funding levels. Diverting PPC dollars would eliminate existing cost-effective ratepayer and climate benefits. For these reasons, the Northwest Energy Coalition would oppose any version of House Bill 3386 that diverts public purpose charge dollars. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel?
Quick question.
Representative
Thank you,
Johnson.
I appreciate it. Brian, I think you probably would know this better there as well as anyone in the room, but I wanted to talk about the type of blending agents.
Pardon?
Talk about the type of blending agents that are available out there. My recollection from the original discussion of LCFS is that corn-based ethanol will only get you so far, right, because of its carbon intensity?
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, yes, they have, because of transportation costs and other items, there's a lot of pathways, but they are probably the first to go out in 2018. In terms of compliance.
So once corn-based ethanol doesn't pass muster as a blending agent, what's next, and what's the supply chain look like for that for both Oregon and California?
You have perhaps a little more time with Northwest corn. Then you're looking at trying to find sugarcane ethanol. That hasn't been showing up, Mark. And according to what DEQ's mapping is, we're going to have a huge number of EV vehicles that are going to replace this. It's 170 million gallons of fuel they got to replace. So it doesn't look like there's a lot of pathways to replace that. And I would like to point out that when California gets more stressed, they're going to be buying the lowest carbon fuels, and those are not going to be available to it because a lot of those are not having that much quantity to be able to feed the whole thing once you lose a huge amount of Midwest corn. 99% of the credits generated in Oregon to date are from biodiesel and corn ethanol, and the vast majority is Midwest.
So we're going to need a pipeline to Brazil. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here.
And thank you for not asking me about Megajoule. I'm referring to
lawyers aren't supposed to know math.
We don't.
Memorize it. Thank you. I'm going to, and we have one person signed up that is available by phone, and this will be the last person. And committee, if you do have to move along, I understand. But I'm going to get this testimony, then we'll be complete. You're welcome. We may be off the hook.
Sounds like a voicemail.
The person you are trying to reach is unavailable.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks everybody that came today, and everybody that presented testimony, thank you very much. The public hearing on HB 2481 and HB 3386 is closed. And I am adjourning the House Committee on Energy and Environment. House Committee on Energy and Environment. Yes.